Session number 13265, wheel number 11.
Is Marsden wheel 11?
The main legs were somewhere around 4 inches in diameter. And the whole undercarriage assembly was very strong indeed. A little while later, I saw an aircraft taxi across a filled bomb crater and settle in. The wheel settled in the filling, well above the axle. And of course he was bogged. And the pilot was flapping, and so I went in front to control him from the ground, starboard port front, so that I could see the pilot, he could see me. And I indicated that he should give his port engines full blast and nothing on the starboard engines, to try to lift it out. Unfortunately, he read me wrongly, and he gave his starboard engines full blast and nothing on the port, and the aircraft promptly screwed itself round in this bomb crater and simply scooped the earth out with the wheel. Now, on some aeroplanes, that would have twisted the undercarriage off, I'm sure. But it simply scooped the soft earth out as though it were a big ice cream scoop. And, of course, there it was, properly stuck, and then we had to dig the damn thing out and haul it out. And in those days, that meant getting all the squadron there and ropes and hauling it out with manpower, among other things. Yeah, we were not yet well established with the heavyweight tractors. We lost another aircraft in these early days. It's flying south to Radlett. Quite probably, I would think, it was flying to Radlett to pick up some spares and bring them back. Because by this time we had a French engineer on a squadron, a lot of the squadron, civilian engineer, who was a Messier specialist. And he'd been brought out of France by one of the Handley Page chaps who, during the fall of France, went into France. I don't know whether he took trucks with him or whether he scrounged trucks up when he got there, but he went into France to the Messier factory, and he collected all the Messier tools that were essential to the Halifax, because Messier parts were being manufactured over there before the Rubrioin got going. And he brought all the necessary gear back and all the drawings and all the information he could get, and brought this gear back to England, and this French engineer came with him. I don't know if there any more came with him, but I think that may have been the story which Neville Shute eventually used as Pied Piper. You know the one?
Yes.
Anyway, that was what we understood at the time on the squadron. And I see, since it that kind of story tends to be true in the services, you know, when you're as close to it as that. Because we were close to Handley Pages, in the sense of being close to them with the new aircraft and their engineers backwards and forwards, just as we were close to Royce's, because Royce's engineer were backwards and forwards to us, the civilian engineers, as distinct from group engineers, you know, service group engineers and so on. And like any sort of closed shop or whatever, these stories do travel around, and they do tend to have a basis of truth, whatever accretions occur in the course of passage. And anyway, this kite took off. Two of the buds thought that they might get a little time at home and bungled a flight. One of them was a Corporal Hancock and the other one was an LAC. As the kite taxied to the end of the runway, the LAC remembered he hadn't locked his toolbox and passed the word to the pilot, and he stopped, dropped out, closed the hatch and galloped off back to the hangars, and the aircraft carried on and flew into a stuffed cloud somewhere near Biggleswade. Stuffed cloud, it's a cloud with a hill in it, and it doesn't work out very well usually. We found out afterwards the kite was lost and all in it. We found out afterwards that from the crash investigation, either one or two starboard engines had been shut down in flight, or had shut down in flight, or stopped in flight, whatever. And it had been assumed that because the props continued to windmill, as they do, it hadn't been noticed by the pilot. There was cloud and so on, so they may have been in cloud a little, to some extent. All the readings tend to remain good, because the other two engines are actually driving them, so that you may get a little bit of loss of speed and maybe a little bit of loss of revs, but because those props are windmill and they're constant speed units, then they will continue to rev and show an indication on the rev counters. Oil pressure shows, boost pressure will show. The fuel's not being turned off, so I mean, you are, whilst they're spinning, there's going to be some risk of fire, but it won't show. And of course it'll take a little while for temperatures to drop. But whilst you're doing this, did I say the starboard engine's cut? Port engines, whichever. Whilst you're doing it, you're not going to be flying a straight course. You're going to swing, because the engines at one side are going to be unbalanced. No power at the other. And the kite simply had flown off course and flew into the hills, I believe, somewhere in the Biggleswade area, those hills east of Biggleswade where the British Bird Association people are, somewhere in that area. And one aircraft lost, and Corporal Hancock buys it just for the sake of a trip home. Wife and kids gone, you know. So that was another loss. Then it was decided that it might be necessary to practice for daylight operations. And so we had three aircraft formed up. At the time I thought that one of them was being flown by Leonard Cheshire. But Ken Merrick, who wrote the Halifax book and has researched it, tells me that it must have been flown by Franklin. But I watched this takeoff, and I can remember, I've remembered ever since. I was convinced. I thought at the time that Cheshire was flying that aircraft, 8-6. And I forget who was leading. There were a Vic of three. They took off up the, what would it be? I suppose the southern, heading facing west to the southern edge of the of Linton-on-Ouse Aerodrome. They didn't take off on a runway, because the three Halifaxes form a fairly sizable Vic. They took off on grass. And whoever was flying 8-6 got off in a bit of a fighter takeoff. He got off a bit early, and he was retracting his undercart when the kite was still only 6 or 8 feet off the deck, maybe less. Found himself overtaking the leader, throttled back, and of course, throttling back, the kite lost height because he's lost power and speed, and the half retracted undercarriage touched the deck with the leg half retracted. I can't visualise. I try offhand, I would say it was the starboard leg. When I picture it in my mind, that, which was slightly lower, and that touched and got the load of the aeroplane on it and bidged the undercart, because they took off. I can't remember whether it retracted fully or not, because we were busy. We watched them take off and formate, and they went off and then did local formation flying at various altitudes and so on, tucking in fairly close. But when they came back, 86 couldn't lower its undercarriage. As I say, I always think of it as Cheshire flying it. And we heard that the order was given to fly the aircraft out over the Atlantic and to bail out over Ireland, over Northern Ireland, fly it over that way and bail out, because so far no one had yet belly landed Halifax, and they didn't want run any risks with losing crew and so on. That was the scuttlebutt that went round, you know, immediately around the station. By this time, we had, well, I had at any rate, I'd moved from the round the perimeter track, and I was up by our hangars. And I can recall standing in front of the hangar and seeing this kite coming round at about a couple of thousand feet and simply droning round, and I can't recall whether or not he jettisoned fuel. I think he had to fly around until his fuel was nearly out, and he finally came in and landed down the same piece of ground where the takeoff had been, wheels up. So we now had the job of shifting Halifax off the aerodrome and into the hangar, and the odd thing is that I can't remember just how we did it. I can recall one or two others of like kind, but I guess we probably had some airbags, but at this stage of the game, when we had a Halifax bellied, generally speaking, we had to get the whole squadron out underneath and as many people as possible under one wing, say, and raise it on our backs simply by muscle. And having done that, the trick was that another gang of bods got all our toolboxes and brought them along, and we then stepped onto the toolboxes and lifted again to raise the kite just that bit extra. It gave you about another 10 inches or a foot, and that allowed them to get the airbags underneath. Or I think at this date we hadn't got airbags. The thing then was that they were under the undercart, under the inboard engines, they were blocked up, and under the belly of the kite they were blocked up with sleepers and sandbags. And then we went to the rear end of the fuselage and we did the same thing there. And then we went to the other outer wing, and we eventually we built the kite up on sleepers, cross sleepers and sandbags, until we had it high enough to get a recovery trolley underneath. The recovery trolleys were about 6 or 8 feet square and mounted on four very large, very heavy duty rubber tyres, you know, inflated tyres, very heavily built, and the aircraft was cradled on that, on sandbags, very carefully under the point of balance, of course, and then the whole thing towed away by tractor if you had a tractor, and if not, then it was bodies to work, you know, 2-6 again, all the bodies to work, with tow rope and so on, and lines to the wingtips and lines to the tailwheel to stabilise the thing, and you simply hauled it away and off to the hangar. And I mentioned 2-6 there. I haven't gone into that before, have I? The old service cry of 2-6. Well, in the RAF, in those days, whenever you needed muscle power for anything at all, you bellowed 2-6! So that folks would know and run away the other direction, mostly, of course. You had to scout round. Generally speaking, there were volunteers came up to see what was what, and you got the muscles you needed. And it was then 2-6 on the... Of course, if you hangar doors open or closed, 2-6 on the doors was the shout. And since people around the hangar were there on duty, and that was it. You got a working party. 2-6, I think, is derived from the system of numbering the gun team in the old muzzle loading days in the Navy. And numbers 2 and number 6 were the ones who handled the breaching ropes, so when the gun was fired, the breaching ropes were promptly hauled up by 2 and 6, and the other members of the team tailed onto them and hauled the gun to haul the gun forward into its firing position. When it was fired, of course, it had on recoil, had come back inboard and could then be dealt with. You won't want me to go into the routine for that, will you?
No.
The breaching ropes went from the gun trolley to ring bolts on the bulwarks or whatever, and came back so that the gun could be hauled out to fire. After all, when you fired those guns, you didn't want to set the ship on fire, so you wanted the muzzle well outboard. And 2 and 6, as I say, were those gun numbers, and so that 2-6 became an established yell in the Navy. And then in the First World War, you get naval types associated with the RFC and become members of the RFC. You get the RAF or the RFC working with the Royal Naval Air Service as cross-fertilisation. And again after the war, when the Fleet Air Arm is set up, you get the RAF people working in the Fleet Air Arm. So that service slang underwent considerable cross-fertilisation in that respect. And that's one of the terms which came across into the RAF. I think winger came into the RAF from the Navy.
What does that mean?
A mate, a chap you work with. It sounds as though it's an RAF term, but isn't. You know, it sounds as though he's your wingman, the chap who flies on your or the wingtips or whatever, but in fact, I think that comes from the Navy. I haven't given much thought to that kind of thing lately, but it's the sort of thing you can easily produce an essay on. A tremendous number of service terms were in the RAF were derived from those sources. Anyway, hangar doors were probably in sections, 4 or 6 sections on a hangar entrance. Hangar entrances were 100 foot, 90 or 100 foot, and 10, a good 20 feet high, I would say, maybe a little bit more. The doors themselves were built on steel channel, standard girder sections, channel sections, somewhere at least 6 inches in depth or thickness, maybe more, faced with a steel plate ...12 gauge... ...10 gauge... 3.32 and 1/8 inch in thickness at least. Again, maybe more offhand. It's a long time since I looked closely. And the lower 12 foot of each door was double skinned and filled inside with shingle. This was proofing against gunfire and so on. That was what I understood at the time. They ran on steel rollers on the decks, which constantly got filled with grit from engine running, blowing sand and grit about, and were never clean unless you'd only clean them that moment. So it was always hard going, shifting over the doors on those runners. The top was stabilised on steel rollers running in a channel. And the doors were officially meant to be moved by means of a gear mechanism from the outside, using a big heavy steel crank of the order of about 18 inches on the crank throw, 12, 18 inches, something of that order, and quite a long handle so you could get two men on the handle. And I mean heavy, you know, this is of the order of well over an inch spindle on the crank, on the handle, where you put it into the door. And if the doors were in good order, two men could turn one of those with an effort and open and close the doors. Generally speaking, because of the gravel and grit in the channels and so on, it took more than that, and you had to get everybody in sight to push as well as to turn, hence the need for 2-6 on the doors. That's a long something about nothing, isn't it?
I've never heard it before.
By this time, of course, all the stations have been camouflaged. The airfields themselves are camouflaged using black bituminous material sprayed on to represent tree shadows and hedge shadows. And the result, the hangars have been sprayed similarly in a mixture of green and brown, and some of this black also, so that from the air it's quite easy to lose an airfield to the naked eye. Shows up, photographs will always pick them up, but it was not unknown at this time for Sprog pilots to take off from a field and promptly get lost. They couldn't even see where they'd come from, because the runways themselves, you see, were shaded in with the camouflage. And it needed quite an eye. You needed to get used to see what you were looking at, instead of look at what you were seeing, you know. The aircraft by now had hard standings, so that all the way around the field there were fingers coming off the perimeter track with circular concrete hard standings large enough for large aircraft to taxi in and turn round on. And this was a big help from the days when the airfields were just grass, and wet weather was a real pain in the neck when aircraft could get bogged. You know, bigger, heavier aircraft, and aircraft which were bombed up, of course, ran into big problems on fields which were not thoroughly stable. So this made a big difference. Unfortunately, dispersal around the perimeter in this fashion also meant that if you were tied to a particular aircraft, you were quite a long way from any shelter, so that unless you could use the aircraft as shelter, in bad weather, things could get a bit miserable. And in the Yorkshire winters, things got downright miserable. I'd already suffered just a touch of frostbite in the first winter of the war at Weston-super-Mare at Locking. I'd been on guard duty one night, 2 foot of snow, and the snow still falling, and yet the temperature freezing well below. It's a thing I've rarely come across in England, where the below zero temperatures, well below zero temperatures, and snow with quite large flakes. You know, it's quite, to me, that's uncommon. Anyway, I was on guard duty. I had 2 pairs of uniform trousers on, 2 of everything else that I'd got on, including socks, inside my gum boots, and practically everything I could wear, including my cap comforter on my head and the field service cap pulled down. And I still got just a little touch of frostbite on my left ear. It was a terrible cold night. But anyway, the winter of 40-41, I think, was probably even colder, certainly for longer. I think we had frost for days on end, and that heavy snow. And we were supplied with engine covers and catalytic heaters. And the engine covers were like tall tents with semicircular heads on, large enough to give working space cover over a Merlin engine, so that they would have been 6-7 feet in length. They were erected in such a fashion that the propeller was outside, so that the front face of the tent came behind the propeller blades, and they reached to the leading edge of the wing, covering the engine. They were canvas covered from the ground up, and I don't remember whether they were zip fastened in places or whether it was press button fastenings or what. I've forgotten the fastenings. The bottom edges, of course, were fastened down with tent pegs, and inside we installed catalytic heaters, which are trays, look like trays, covered with a gauze. Now, the gauze is a platinum wire gauze, or I don't know if it's pure platinum or a platinum alloy, and it sits just above a reservoir covered with felt wicks. Or I can't remember whether it was a flat-faced felt or whether there were actual wicks there, but a reservoir in which one poured clean petrol, unleaded petrol. And the vapour rising from the petrol causes a catalytic reaction on the platinum wire, which releases heat. And there was sufficient heat from these heaters, which were 2 or 3 feet long and a foot wide or so, sufficient heat to dispel the severe frost